Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Brendan Ogg's life was filled with promise. He was a student, an aspiring poet, a talented performer in theater, fraternity member with a tightly knit circle of friends. Then came the headaches, and in his sophomore year at the University of Michigan, a devastating diagnosis. A brain tumor eventually took Brendan's life in 2010 at just 20 years of age. But friends have found ways to keep his memory alive in film, poetry, and art. On Point, Brendan's story, and what it means to lose a friend so young. You can join the conversation. Have you lost a friend? How are you honoring his or her life? What is it about the bond of friendship that makes the loss so profound? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Silver Spring, Maryland, is Brendan Ogg's mother, Jackie Ogg. Jackie, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Now, of course, Jackie, we are neighbors and friends. Your son, Brendan, grew up with my daughter, Mary Jean. He was in my house many times. But for all the readers, or excuse me, all the listeners out there who don't know Brendan, tell us about him.
My pleasure. Actually, introduce everybody to Brendan. He was a great guy. He was charming. He was witty. He was handsome, says his mother. He was a typical all-around teenager. He, loved to play Frisbee. As you mentioned, starred in theater, was into hanging out, music, movies. He had a bit of an ego. He could be an absent-minded professor at times. But really, from early on, he was just one of those kids that loved to read and then later loved to write. So that by the time he graduated high school, he was, for that age, in many ways, I would say, at the top of his game. He had a great group of friends, some he'd known since preschool and elementary school, like Mary Jean. And, he was off to Michigan to study English. And, he was just getting launched.
So he goes off to Michigan. He has a freshman year. And he comes home at the end of the fall semester, sophomore year. Tell us what happened.
Well, so he came home and he was complaining of headaches, and we were thinking stress, migraines, but they were pretty bad. He physically got sick with some of these headaches, and so we had an MRI on Christmas Eve, 2008, and this told us otherwise, that it was a brain tumor deep in the brain, in the thalamus, and that was a Wednesday. And he had the biopsy the following Monday. Then things really, went from worse to even more worse. things got really bad. He suffered a hemorrhagic stroke after the biopsy. And then counting the biopsy, Brendan had 5 neurosurgeries in 7 days. So, our world just stopped. And then in addition to the sort of cloud of the cancer diagnosis, Brendan spent 5 weeks at the National Rehab Hospital learning to walk again, really regaining his ability to concentrate, to focus, to remember. He essentially had, a traumatic brain injury, and he was getting his way back both physically and cognitively.
And, of course, Brendan had a very, very difficult final year, and friends and family were very close to him throughout that process, and he's still close to them in many ways, and that's what we're going to be talking about later with some of them. Talk a little bit about how the film, the poetry readings, the art that we'll be discussing later in the hour from people who are trying to keep Brendan's memory alive, what does that mean to you?
Oh, it just means a tremendous amount. I mean, really, from the moment the MRI results were known, Brendan and really for the, in the next 14 months of his life, he just totally turned to his friends, and they did not disappoint. They were there for him 100%, this was sophomore and then junior year in college for many of them, so they were traveling great distances and trying to keep in touch in many different ways. Some were home here locally and came home every weekend or came, in the afternoons to hang out and Brendan was a student of poetry, and some of what they did was just read poetry, or Brendan would, in order to get his memory back, he would challenge himself to sort of memorize poems. He had an affinity for poets from past eras, and Ode to Nightingale was one of the favorites that he would try to memorize. And he just, his life was infused with poetry. And, not all of his friends were literary mind, he had that same bend, but they all knew that was important to Brendan. And they saw Brendan go from essentially being bedridden, confused, at times inappropriate and disoriented, to really getting back to more and more of himself. He was walking sometimes without a cane, back to school, taking English classes at Maryland, doing very well, going to concerts and just hanging out. Was he the same as he was before the surgeries? No, not exactly. But he was still, in so many ways, Brendan. He was writing them poems and, rhyming their names with other things, and just, and he's still very charming. And the notion to us that his friends witnessed that progress and nurtured it, and they essentially shared it with us, his family. They really were part of our caring team for him during this time, and it remains a comfort for us to know that how much Brendan meant to them, and that what they went through, really what we all went through, will continue to be part of their lives in our lives. And we can talk more a little bit about the sort of the poetry, I think one of your guests is a psychiatrist, and maybe he'll touch more on this. But one of the things that surprises us is that we learn that for many people Brendan's age who go through something like this, the friends, they sometimes scatter. They just don't know how to be there for someone. It's different than if you're a child and your parents are coaching you through it, or you're, older. And there are more programs out there and efforts to target this age population, but this young adults and their peers, they are the central support system in many ways, and I don't know what we would have done without them. And
Jackie, you talked about what these friends witnessed. I'm going to let you go and bring in a couple of those friends and talk about how they are sharing what they witnessed with others, so other people can experience it as well. Jackie Ogg, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Joining me now from Arlington, Virginia, is one of Brendan Ogg's friends, Rachel Coppolo. She's a recent graduate of Northwestern University. And while there, she co-wrote and co-produced a film inspired by Brendan's life. It's called Chase. You can watch the trailer at our website, onpointradio.org. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I want to talk to you about how you reacted when you heard the news of Brendan's illness. But before I do that, let's play a little clip from your film. In this scene, Chase's mother gives his friend, a girl named Mall, a gentle warning before she walks into the hospital room.
There were some complications, so he's himself in some ways and not himself in other ways. But it's nothing to worry about now, honey. Just enjoy each other's company.
Rachel, what was the experience like as you and my daughter and others in your circle of friends enjoyed Brendan's company in the last year of his life?
Well, when he was diagnosed at the end of 2008, there often wouldn't be a time within a 10-minute span where I wouldn't think about him five times. But that doesn't mean we talked about it. That doesn't mean we shared our fears and our frustrations, and partly because I just couldn't find a language that I could put into words what was going on. I find it ironic that I'm now telling hundreds of strangers what I found very difficult to talk about a year ago. But snippets of conversations would replay in my head, and my mom told me that the only way to get it out of my head would be to put it on paper. So I started writing memories about Brendan and just from our whole friend group and me in particular, and then this random compilation of pieces formed, I wrote into a screenplay, and because that was the language I found I could relate to and talk about it in, where I couldn't really talk about it emotionally as easily.
And you found not only the words, but the imagery that you put on film in the movie. Talk about how that came together, how you took your screenplay and turned it into that remarkably polished, finished production.
Yeah, well, you know, with the actors, my script was originally 30 pages or something. I can make this hours long, but we wanted about a 10-minute short. So when I'd rehearse with the actors, we would rehearse scenes that I'd cut to try to get a richer character for them to draw on. And we would play a lot of improv games where I would give them a scenario that had actually happened and see them play it out. So I felt like, you know, in the course of a month, they really got to know Brendan just as I knew him. And so they were able to bring him to life incredibly well. And, you know, I added those small details like the mannerisms of the hand clamping up and the head spasms because he had partial movement troubles on his left side. So
basically, everything that we see in this film is a close cousin of something that you witnessed in the hospital room with Brendan?
Yeah, and I like to think of it as, you know, I wanted to make a film about my group of friends, but I really couldn't fit us all in 10 minutes. So I tried to distill all of our memories and all of our personal connections with Brendan into these two characters. So I'm not necessarily the main character, but we all are. It's a collage.
Rachel, stick with us. We'll be talking about the special grief that comes with the loss of a friend and how young people can keep moving forward. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about friendship and grief. Rachel Coppolo's here. She lost her good friend Brendan Ogg in 2010. He was 20 years old when he succumbed to a brain tumor. She made a documentary inspired by Brendan called Chase. In this scene, Chase and his friend Maul are together in his hospital room watching the movie The Squid and the Whale.
What did that subtitle say? I have trouble reading with my left eye.
New York, 1986.
They're brothers?
Yes.
Frank.
And they're fighting.
Put that peanut up your nose.
Why?
We don't know yet.
Pickle.
Who are they again?
Got it.
We're reading a tale of two sisters in English.
Brothers.
That was a very powerful scene, Rachel, because it captured what I would hear about from my daughter when she came back from seeing Brendan and talking about the challenge of being present with him, supporting him, but dealing with the fact that the communication was pretty asymmetrical and it was sometimes hard to sustain a conversation. What was that like for you?
Yeah, we would have very circular conversations at first, and it did get better with time, but watching a movie was always a challenge, whether it was subtitles or explaining the plot every 2 minutes, because he did have short-term memory loss. And initially I wrote into the script a lot of explanation from the nurse describing what was going on and why his social filter was gone and he would say inappropriate things and why his memory was shoddy, but you know, I ended up cutting that because it spoke for itself. You know, just like I didn't have anyone explaining it to me as we lived through it, I didn't want to walk the audience through it. So,
Rachel, you had a showing of your film at Northwestern, where you've just graduated. In the reaction that you've gotten from classmates and others who have seen it, are you finding from others that the experiences that you had were more widely shared than you'd realized? Have you found people who've told you that they experienced similar things in their own lives?
Yeah, I've been actually kind of surprised at how this film is resonating with people. I wrote it initially as a coping mechanism, as a self-expression, but it became something that people could consume generally and other people definitely could relate to it. There were a lot of tears in the audience at the end of it.
The I experienced some of that in watching it myself. Tell me a little bit about how where the film goes from here. I know that you've entered it in some festivals. Are you hoping that this has a life beyond what you experienced at Northwestern?
Yeah, I hope so. We did submit it to a few festivals, and we're waiting to hear back. I did begin to realize that to ensure that this film could have a life of its own, I had to let go a lot of the personal story and, you know, make decisions that would make this film speak for itself. So Brendan shines throughout, but...
Who are the actors, by the way? And where did you get them?
I got them at Northwestern, and a funny story about Will Sondheim, who plays Chase, who plays Brendan's character. He sort of waltzed into the audition room and asked, Is this the meeting for X, Y, Z, whatever? And we look behind us, who's this guy coming in here? So friendly. And he asked us what this was. We told him, and he asked if he could audition, and he did on the spot. And it was just such a remarkably Brendan thing to do, to just waltz into the room, charm everybody, outshine everybody. And so he got
the part. So you found him by accident?
Yeah, basically, serendipity.
I'd like to bring in another one of Brendan's friends into this conversation. Joining us now from Bozeman, Montana, is Tommy Hester. Tommy met Brendan Ogg in kindergarten. He graduated in 2011 from Williams College, and he honored his friend with a poetry reading of Brendan's work at Williams. Welcome to On Point, Tommy.
Hi, John.
One of the poems that you read at Williams was entitled Neurosurgeon. Could you read that for us now?
Yes, absolutely. So it's entitled, To My Neurosurgeon, After a Month in Rehab, Unforeseen. No longer can I feel the riptide roar of death, where black water overwhelms and pulls beneath, filling my lungs with sand. I watch the neurosurgeon take his final, skillful stand, inhaling the strange glioma beast after it had wrecked the delicate snowflake patterns in my brain. But here I am, alive and writing of it still, of how on my victorious return, he had the grace to apologize, and how as I left he gave me thanks, and said, you made my day, when after all, he had made mine as well, and the one before, and all of those ahead.
Tommy, when you decided to do the reading at Williams, what were you thinking, what was your goal, and what was that like sitting on stage with people who didn't know Brendan and reading this very intimate material?
Mm-hmm. Well, I, as we had talked about this entire program, we have this very, very tight-knit group of friends. And so the entire time when we were all dealing with this illness and then the loss of Brendan, It was really nice because I had this very strong support structure. But the problem with that was it was very hard for me personally to talk with people outside of that very strong structure about what had happened. But Brendan had left us with this great book of poetry, and I just remember reading it over and over again and thinking that other people needed to kind of experience this. And as much as it was going to make me uncomfortable and we all had days where I speak for a lot of people in this situation. I feel like where you just want to crawl into a shell and don't want to do anything. But I thought I needed to kind of spread this word because these poems and all the messages that he puts out, I would have loved to hear these even if I had never known Brendan, and they're very, very inspirational. And so,
do you think the guys in Brendan's group of friends experienced? And Rachel, I'll bring you in on this afterwards. Experienced the grief and coping afterward in much different ways than the girls.
I feel like we had pretty similar experiences, I feel like. It really, as much as before it was a group of kind of guys and then there's a group of girls and there was a little bit of a boundary, this whole struggle, I feel like, really brought us together. I mean, as soon as we heard the news on Christmas Eve, we all gathered at my friend Paul's house immediately. And it wasn't like, oh, like, like, should we call these girls? It was just, it was an entire group of people all being supportive and kind of really brought us all together and made us one cohesive whole.
I want to go to the phones because we've got callers. Mike from Boston is on the line. Mike, welcome to the program.
Yeah, how you doing, John?
What's your question or comment?
Well, I just I had a similar experience. I went to Northeastern, and my two best friends and roommates both died while we were in school, one from drugs and then another from, no one really actually knows what happened, but he hit his head somehow one night, made it home, and then the next day was fine, and then that night died in his sleep from a slow brain bleed. And both those deaths happened within about 10 months of each other. I mean, it seems like the subject that you guys are talking about, they had a great outlet for their grief, and that I think is something that's very important, because I didn't. There wasn't, you know, none of my buddies were involved in anything, you know, in particular. They were just, you know, business students. So actually, one friend actually did have a online sort of almost like a Facebook where you could go on and, you know, post memories, and that actually people do still today. People are still updating that, and that is actually a great way to remember them. Just something to go, local space where people that are, you know, grieving can go.
How are you doing now, Mike?
I'm doing much better, but it was, you know, that happened in, you know, I think like around like 02. And, you know, it was a rough few years. I tried opiates for the first time, and after my second best friend died, and that wasn't something I ever thought I was going to be doing. But I was prescribed them, liked them. It happened at a point where I was, you know, still grieving from my first best friend, and then my second best friend had happened too. So that I got tied up in that for about a year. But went, got help, you know, I've been fine since. But still, you know, it was a bump in the road. And
well, a very big bump in the road. And Mike, I appreciate your call. I want to bring in a voice into the conversation. Joining me into the studio is Dr. Stuart Goldman, child and adolescent psychiatrist at Children's Hospital in Boston. Welcome to the show, Dr. Goldman.
Hi, John.
Mike was just making the point that he didn't have an outlet for expression, and some of his friends didn't, as Rachel and Tommy have through poetry and film. What do you find is a typical experience? Are there many young people who lose a friend who simply don't have any way of expressing what they're feeling?
Well, you know, I think that there needs to be some kind of structure to help people mourn the loss that they have, and that religion for many people serves that purpose. Friends provide that kind of structure. There's a whole wide variety of ways of trying to honor and remember your friends and then mourn their loss and then gradually move on. And without that, it sounds like the caller didn't really have that. There are all kinds of possible adverse outcomes.
Do young people need different kinds of structure than older people like me who lose parents in what seems like a more natural progression of life?
So, you know, I think you sort of strike the chord there, because it's not a natural position for most young people to be in. They find themselves confronted with their own mortality in a way that's sort of developmentally not expected. And they also have the idea that this could happen to me. And so they end up having these very mixed sets of feelings of, on the one hand, wanting to be helpful, wanting to be a good friend, and the other hand, being terrified by their own mortality, which they've mostly been able to not look at up to this point in life.
I want to go to another caller, Mindy from New Haven, Connecticut. Mindy, welcome to the show.
Hi, John.
What's your comment or question?
My comment is that I'm a creative writing teacher at an arts high school in New Haven, Connecticut. And in our department, a set of my students decided to write a book called A Better Place, which is a collection of stories, poems, letters to people who've died. And the reason we came up with this idea is that so many teenagers have died from gun violence in New Haven and in other cities. And we believe in, you know, creative expression as a way to heal and think and connect and create community. So the kids decided to pick this topic and collect from themselves. They wrote, and they also collected from other students, friends, and even family members. And now we're going to publish the book in September.
And Do you get the feeling that this has been very helpful, a positive step forward for these children who are working on the book?
Yeah, absolutely, because the reason is, the thing that started us is there's just no place in school to talk about this sort of thing. So the kids would come in and they would be upset and they would be grieving, but there would be no time for that, no space for that. There just wasn't any setup for the kind of grief that happens when young people lose people, especially through gun violence. So we decided to make a big poster and have people sign it and express their feelings, and then we decided to, so many people wanted to do that, we decided to actually make a collection and create a book so that people could have a way to express their grief in a healthy way. And also during the class, we had to work together and go through, you know, our own grief, and that was very challenging but very bonding. So it turned into a really big community building thing. So now people have many more avenues to express their grief and connect and get support in healthy ways, rather than through retaliation and other ways. You know, if you don't have a healthy way to express around this stuff, it can turn out bad.
Mindy, it sounds like a wonderfully positive experience. Rachel Coppolo, those children, high school kids, you were barely out of high school when Brendan became ill. Does that sound like a comparable experience, maybe expressed somewhat differently and in different circumstances, to what you and your friends went through?
Yeah, I think that in the midst of everything, the emotions involved in grief is very complicated. You know, you have sadness, anger, frustration, humor, guilt. They're all rolled into this muddy color. And so with a creative outlet, or with time also helps, you can start analyzing each emotion individually and, you know, break it down, and the emotions are less raw, so you can think about them without feeling them, and that's a huge difference.
Dr. Goldman, words as therapy?
Well, you know, certainly as a psychiatrist, I'm a strong believer in words as therapy, and I think people have a variety of ways in which they mourn their own losses. It sounds like both in New Haven and Rachel had a sort of a little bit of a network to try to work through this. And, of course, having a social structure, whether it's peers or whether it's family or religion, is a great help. I think there are also other ways to honor and remember people who have been lost, so that I know young people who have an annual fundraising basketball game for a young person who died, who was remembered each year in the basketball game. And the first years they raised more money, and subsequent years they raised a little bit less money. But every year they do this as a way of remembering and honoring the person who was so important to them.
Do you find much in the way of different approaches in different socioeconomic circumstances, where kids with more resources, more ability, more access to assistance react one way, but people who don't have those resources have a more difficult time?
Well, you know, resources come in many different ways. It's really about having the people around you who can help you cope with this, you know, unthinkable, previously unimaginable loss. Children who have had, and young adults who have had more experiences writing or in the creative arts, see that as a valid way and an accessible way. People who don't have that, you know, have other kinds of ways too. There are people who build structures, people who plant trees, but some way of memorializing the person who was so important.
Tommy, talk a little bit about now going forward as you've left college. Has the circle of friends that you all formed in high school, have you all scattered? Do you still communicate? Are you keeping alive the bonds that were deepened in that experience of being with Brendan?
Oh, we're absolutely very much still in touch. This whole experience. I mean, we were always great friends before this, but you go through something like this, losing a best friend, essentially a brother, and it really, like, this the year that he had when he was sick, as terrible as it was also one of the most inspirational and forming years of my life, because it really influenced who I am today and who our group of friends are today.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about grief and the loss of a friend. We're joined by Dr. Stuart Goldman, child and adolescent psychiatrist at Children's Hospital in Boston, and by Rachel Coppolo and Tommy Hester, friends of Brendan Ogg, who passed away in 2010 at age 20. And we're also joined by callers who are phoning in with their own recollections and experiences. Let's go to Cindy from Bloomfield, Connecticut. Cindy, welcome to the show, and what's your comment?
Hi, Tom. Well, my comment is, and I'll make the explanation kind of brief because it's not about me, but I lost my husband on September 11th, and I had two young children, 7 and 8. And I think what has helped our family are two things. And one is that you become part of this family that you never really wanted to have. And what I mean by that is all of these people rally around you. So there's this yin and yang that goes on. Many people stepped forward and were very kind to us and really sort of pulled us through the tragedy by doing very, very kind things for our family. They remembered Mike. They told us stories about him. They did things in his memory. We found out things about him that we might not have ever known, from his childhood to his days in the Navy to his days when he was working at Marsh, which was an insurance brokerage firm. And that all helped to keep his memory alive. We established a scholarship in his name. And those are all things that would not have happened had he not died. And I also, and my children also, got close with this whole group of people who had been through a similar experience. So you become part of this group that, you know, you'd give it all back in a heartbeat to get your loved one back, but I so value all of those relationships.
Cindy, do you think your friends 10 years later feel those bonds of connection and community as strongly as you do?
Yes, absolutely. We all say the same thing. We're part of this group of people that are really and truly family that we never wanted to have or be a part of, yet we wouldn't trade for anything except having our loved ones back.
Incredibly bittersweet experience. Cindy, thanks for calling. Dr. Goldman?
Well, you know, the caller was very fortunate to have this group to be part of. One of the things that she notes, and it's not been her case, but over time, sometimes for people, the supports drift away. And each time one goes through, we're coming up to the 10th year anniversary of 9/11. And each time we come up to an anniversary or a life event, a graduation for high school, one has to sort of recreate the world, now incorporating the sense of loss and being part of this group, as she said, that she didn't really want to be part of.
You wonder how those anniversary moments are for people to deal with. Rachel, when you think about when you come up on anniversary moments of when Brendan became ill or when he passed away, which is now more than a year, how does that how does that affect you in terms of the processing of the whole experience?
Yeah, well, we've had a few milestones. His birthday was in September. I like to buy myself a CD that he would have bought, or a DVD, and watch one of his favorite movies, or just take the day to myself to just get to think about him, because, you know, it's hard not to think about him, but when I can just give permission to myself to just have that time, then it's comforting.
We're starting to hear from more callers who've had comparable experiences. Let's go to Jane from Wenham, Massachusetts. Jane, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Tell me about the experience that that you had.
Well, a young man from my children are all on the Y of the North Shore swim team here in Beverly, Massachusetts. And this spring, we tragically lost a young man who was a bright, shining star of a 14-year-old boy. Unbelievably sweet kid, smart, always with a smile on his face. Wanted to be a pediatric cardiologist because his parents had already buried a child who died of a pediatric heart condition. So he was already studying the heart, knew probably more about the heart muscle than a second-year medical student. Everybody, I got to know him very well, and I called him Dr. Mike all the time. And he died in June of a completely freak backyard accident. And the whole team, when they heard that Michael was hurt and in the hospital, just this outpouring of emotion and prayers, and everybody came together for this 14-year-old boy that everybody just adored. His name was Michael Boudreau, and at the wake, I was with my 15-year-old son, and he is a typical 15-year-old boy, and he was just, Michael was supposed to start at St. John's Prep in the fall and was so excited to swim with all of his Y teammates for the prep, and and he had on a prep swimming and diving jacket in his, in the casket, and my son saw him and just fell completely apart. The just raw emotion and grief that overtook him was, I didn't know what to do. I was overtaken as his mother. I didn't know what to do for him. He was so upset. And ever since Michael's death, the whole team has just come together. We're trying to figure out what to do for next season, name a swim meet in his honor, have a fundraiser, and donate money to pediatric cardiology at Children's Hospital, because Michael loved Children's Hospital. And it's just, it's really brought the whole team together. And there's a group of kids down at Y National Championships in Georgia this week, and they dedicated their swim today, their whole meet actually, but they did it this morning at the morning devotion to Michael in his memory, and they talked about, you know, what an incredible young man he was and what a loss it is for all of them. And
wow, it was so just fresh. How do you think the other kids on the team, do you think that they've got the help and the resources they need? Are they handling it on their own? Are they getting counseling?
I don't think anybody from the team, well, we have a team psychologist who helps the kids with their swimming, but, and he was on hand for a long time, and they did have a counseling session for the kids that swam in Michael's practice group, my daughter included. They were all, you know, 14 middle school kids. So they did have counseling for them, and Jim is available to anybody when they need to talk. But the kids just, like, in just on deck, they just will say, hey, remember Michael, because he loved the butterfly. So when they do the butterfly, they'll, you know, you'll see kids post on Facebook, oh, you know, I swam a great fly today, and I remember Michael said it's the little kick that counts. So they always remember the things that he said on deck. And we had a meet this spring, and they all wore, we had caps made up that had Muffin on the side, which was his nickname, so the whole team wore the caps with Muffin on the side. And it, I mean, it's really left a big impression on these kids, the impact that this young man had in his 14
wow.
short years.
Jane, thank you so much for calling. Tommy Hester, it sounds as if that's a story that you can identify with.
Absolutely. I mean, just the support that I received and that all of our friends received was just absolutely tremendous. And something that, I mean, what really struck me is that even outside of my friend group, after it kind of became known through this poetry reading, and then I also I shaved my head when Brendan started losing his hair. So as kind of words started to get out, I guess, around campus that I'd had this friend going through this disease and everything, just there were people that I was acquaintances with or had never really met that would stop and talk to me about it or would relate their own stories much in the same way. And it's kind of a similar thing that people have been saying, that you get brought into this bigger family that is really, really supportive and is really, really great to have in these situations.
Let's go to another caller. Adele is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Adele, what was your experience?
Hi, John. I went through a very tragic experience with our teenage daughter about 10 years ago when she had her first serious boyfriend and he was killed in a car accident. And we learned a lot from this. One was that she was dealing with something that my husband and I had never dealt with. It was like having a young widow in her household. And we decided we would just trust her to tell us what she needed to help her get through it. And one of the things we found was there weren't many resources for teenagers. I could not find a grief group for something like that. So we went online and found GriefNet, and they were able to pair her up with another girl in Ohio who she, of course, never met, who'd had a similar situation, and they paired me up with her mother. And so I emailed back and forth with the mother. She emailed with the girl, and that was extremely helpful. And then the other helpful thing, I think, like I say, was just letting her set the pace, including her deciding that she was not ready to start school 2 weeks after this happened, and we did homeschooling for a semester. So,
how's she doing today? It's 10 years, right? So she's in her late 20s now?
In 11 years, actually. She's doing fine. She's 27 and happy. But I tell you what, it took almost 10 years, I think, for her to get over this, and especially because it was this first love and the agony of trying to figure out how to date and not compare other people to this person. And so it was quite a hard time for everyone, and surprisingly harder for our family than for me when I lost either one of my own parents. Well, I think just the youth factor.
Adele, I'm glad that your daughter is doing well, and I want to address to Dr. Goldman two things about it. First of all, the strategy that Adele mentioned of letting her daughter set the pace for her own recovery, and second, do you find that the grief experience is dramatically different in the recovery from it for people who lose friends through sudden trauma or freak accidents versus those who lose them to long illnesses?
Two great questions. I think that the caller sort of talked about giving her daughter permission to speak, which is critical for parents, and then having the good wisdom to listen. I think parents talked at teenagers and at young people more often than they listen. I think, you know, one of the challenges, you know, for teenagers is the natural position is to be independent. So moving towards your parents is something that feels like you're going backwards rather than forwards. And so it's a challenge for them. And at the same time, they don't have the tools to go forward. And particularly when the death is sudden, which is the way lots of young people die, whether it's homicide or motor vehicle accidents or other kinds of accidents, those are the common causes for death. And people don't have the time to get prepared, you know, and don't have time to sort of build up a social group around them so that they can mourn together. The other thing that the caller mentioned was that it takes a long time. People have to be patient, you know. The real terrible sadness goes after 6 months or a year, but it takes years of going around and around, sort of metabolizing the sadness, the loss at different points in your life to sort of feel like you're back in place. And I'm sure her daughter in her mid-late 20s still thinks sadly back to her boyfriend, although she's moved on in her life.
I want to go now to Sean from Scituate, Massachusetts. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, John.
What's your experience and question or comment?
Sure. My oldest son, Ryan, died in a car crash when he was 16, and he attended Boston College High School here in the Boston area. And what we witnessed was that, in terms of his friends, was that BC High really poured on a lot of resources to help the fellow students and friends express themselves and even figure out how to approach us and share stories and share their own feelings about what they were going through. And then, sadly, you know, also experienced a very different situation in which a few years later, actually one of my very closest friends also lost his son at 16, who went to another school in the area, in which the students really weren't given permission to express themselves. There were members of the administration who I think had the best of intentions, perhaps, but really sort of made arbitrary decisions about what was an acceptable way for these kids to feature their grief and work through it. And it was really a very sad situation, very, very difficult for the family and for friends. And so I guess the observation that I would make is we benefited very much from a very supportive environment in which the kids were sort of helped to figure out how to give words to what they were feeling and very importantly for us to share their stories with us. In another situation in which they were told really that, you know, that in this example, the kids, you know, some of the kids on the hockey team, you know, put together a jersey and signed a jersey in memory of this other boy who died, who had been a member of the hockey team, and it was really a very touching and heartfelt expression. That it wasn't one that was really accepted by the school. I mean, what they were hoping to do was display it, and ultimately that happened. But what struck me is that this sort of reticence on the part of the administration was extraordinarily painful for the family, but also really sort of, I think, difficult for those who were trying so hard to express their fear and their sadness, and kind of were just given the message that wasn't the right way to do it.
Sean, I'm so sorry at the loss of your son, but I'm glad that at least in your experience and his friend's experience, they did have the chance to express themselves and use that to get through it. And we're talking about expression. Brendan Ogg expressed himself, and his friends have been reflecting that in remembering him. And Tommy Hester, I'd like you to ask, as we leave the show, to read The Leaf of Knowledge, which is one of Brendan's poems.
Absolutely. So this is entitled A Leaf of Knowledge. I don't know what the doctor means by mostly within the radiation field. I don't know for how long I will need this cane. I don't know what the scan will look like 1 month, 4 months, 4 years from now. All I know is the air that I breathe in this instant, spring sweet whisper, into my lungs, my friend at my side, his broad hand between my shoulder blades, the living God, the love of my friends and family, and the warm skin of her knee, onto which I lay my cheek, to sleep.
Very powerful, Tommy. Dr. Goldman, is that the kind of therapy, the kind of expression that Sean was mentioning that everyone can benefit from?
You know, it certainly is that Brendan sounds like he was an incredible young person and very fortunate to have good friends and family, and my condolences to one and all. The challenge for so many families is that it's terrifying for parents as well, and so they tend to sort of move away. And fortunately for Brendan, both parents and friends were not so scared, and they were brave enough to help him through it.
Dr. Stuart Goldman, thanks so much. Rachel Coppolo, thank you for being with us. Tommy Hester as well. Really appreciate this fascinating discussion. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. At our website, you'll find a link to Rachel's movie Chase and to Brendan Ogg's poetry. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.